Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. My name is Matt Marin, and I'm the multimedia coordinator from the Communications Department. And with me today is Professor of Law, Business Economics, and Public Policy, David Abrams. He's here to discuss his new article in The Hill, Four Common Sense Ways to Reform Policing in America. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here.
All right. So how did you get interested in studying crime, race, and policing?
So that interest goes back to graduate school for me, which, unlike most of my colleagues, was in economics, not in law. And at that time, I started doing some work on race and juries, the impact of juror race on outcomes, which was ultimately got discontinued, but that was what really got me interested in crime-related topics, and particularly crime and race. And through graduate school, I worked on topics including ones on bail, ones on deterrence, what the longest sentence is to deter crime, and on how judges how race impacts judicial sentencing. So for me, it goes back a while and has continued. That's been a main theme in my research ever since. And it's basically because I think the topics are extremely important, as become once again evident nationwide and worldwide recently. They're in need of serious study, and I think they benefit a lot, not just from tools lawyers have, but also tools that economists have to help understand these issues.
Can you describe some of the research you've done related to stop and frisk over the past decade? What are the challenges in identifying racial bias in policing?
Sure. I got involved in particular, so I was already interested in related topics. I got involved in stop and frisk with the Bailey litigation in Philadelphia, which earlier colleagues, David Radofsky, he was one of the attorneys for plaintiffs. So this was litigation against the city of Philadelphia police department based on policing that violated people's Fourth and 14th Amendment rights. So this was unreasonable search and seizure, and also equal protection. So just, to put it in simpler terms, over-policing and policing with racial disparities. They needed someone to work on some of the numerical and statistical analysis, and that's how I started working on this, given my background on some related topics. I'm still working, believe it or not, on that, even though it settled in 2011, 9 years ago now. The city of Philadelphia has been agreed, they settled at the time and agreed that they would change things and be monitored going forward. And so every year, I analyze the data and produce reports to say how well are they doing? How many people are they stopping? What are the differences between stops of blacks, Hispanics, and white individuals, people of other races, same with frisks, et cetera. And while the number of stops has dropped substantially over that time period, about a third of what it was at its peak. It took a long time to do that. And there's still pretty substantial racial disparities in who gets stopped. You're a lot more likely to get stopped if you're a minority. And that's even accounting for all the other things that might help explain it, like is there more crime in your area? I try to account for all that in my analysis. And that's, of course, what makes it challenging and why it helps to have an economic and statistical background is how do you separate out the impact of race instead of other factors and what end up with people being stopped or frisked. So that work got me started, that case got me started in this line of work, And since I've also worked on similar issues in a number of other locations, including LA, Chicago, Seattle, Milwaukee, and some other places, working with the Department of Justice, ACLU, and other organizations. So this is something that's been going on, not just in Philly. New York got a lot of attention with their stop and frisk issues a little bit after the Bailey case in Philadelphia. This is something that's been prevalent nationwide, and this experience, you know, this real world experience, probably even more, I'd say, than my research on the topic, that led me to I think have a lot of hopefully relevant knowledge and led me to write the op-ed about some ideas for police reform.
Is there any specific city that leads the way in data collection?
Recently, I asked some research assistants if they could find, like, what cities, you know, of the biggest cities, top 25 biggest cities in the country. I asked them, let's go out and see which cities are best at providing real-time data on policing, including stops, including reports of crime and arrests. They came out with 4 out of the top 25. So Philly was in there. So was Seattle, LA, and Denver. Those were the ones that I would, you know, hold up as good examples, at least in this regard. This is providing data that's out there to the public. Now, there's still a bunch of other things I think you need to do beyond that, but, like, to me, that's a great example of something every big city should be doing in 2020.
In your op-ed in The Hill, you make several suggestions, including that unions must stop protecting bad officers, incentivize officers to hold themselves accountable, better data, and more local involvement. What makes your suggestions common sense, and how will they expedite reform in the face of a bureaucratic hamster wheel?
How are they going to expedite reform, and especially given that these are big bureaucracies? It's a tough question. So let me tell you why I think these are important, and why I do think they will help. So first, kind of the reform of police unions. They've been, I think, a big impediment to reform in a lot of places. They tend to, not 100% of the time, but a lot in a lot of places, they tend to kind of reflexively defend officers regardless, almost regardless of what they do. In George Floyd, I did not hear the reflexive defense of him nearly as widespread, although you had mentioned that you did hear one example of that I hadn't heard. But I think in general, I heard much less defense of this kind of behavior than you usually hear. So that's, I think, a very good thing. But I think, like, that's an example of unions, you know, going so far wanting to show their dedication, loyalty to their members, and vice versa, they end up defending some people who should not be members and should not be police. I think that's a reform that now is starting to finally be on the table, and that's something that is going to move the needle appreciably, because if we don't have kind of the union resistance to, say, getting rid of some officers who are not doing the job the way they're supposed to, you know, that's, I think that's, you know, crucial to just to changing a bunch of things. The other suggestions I made, and just to answer the question, so do I think that's possible? Yeah, based on what I'm hearing in the news and from union officials, it sounds like, really, for the first time, and I didn't hear this, and there were other bad examples that got a lot of media attention, this seems different. It seems like it's possible now. Other thoughts. So I mentioned, incentivizing officers and individual officers, and getting better data. Are these common sense solutions? They're at least common sense to an economist, I would say. And low cost. That's right. I mean, you know, again, the data stuff, like, the police departments have actually invested in data acquisition recently. Like, hotspot policing, like trying to figure out like where crimes are flaring up and where they're going to come next. They've spent a lot of money on IT infrastructure in recent years. And so taking that, disseminating it to the public, but and also using it to see how well are we doing, seems like a no-brainer. Like if you, you know, to any economist, but also to any business person, like you're running your business and you don't know how well your people are doing, you don't know when they're doing great or screwing up in a systematic way, you're not incentivizing individual people along those lines to like do better, like give them bonuses when they do great work, but also, you know, don't give them bonuses or potentially penalize them when they do bad work or they make mistakes or they do things that are really bad, like they get attention. I mean, to me, that's common sense. Like anyone who's run a business, who's run an organization, have to incentivize individuals. I think that's a piece, a really key piece that's been missing from a lot of reform efforts. And I, again, sort of feed back into, I think, union resistance. The last proposal I had an op-ed, which was more local involvement. And I think, again, speaks to and is intertwined with some of these other issues, you know, to the extent that local mayors ultimately are the ones who, in many cases, choose the police chiefs and they answer to them, but also, you know, district attorneys who work with them all the time, other attorneys, judges, to the extent that all these people can be involved. And here I'm saying local because I have seen great examples of national organizations who put a lot of effort and money and time into reforms, but if there isn't a local support for that and also local follow-up, if it takes a ton of work and it takes ongoing work from the police department and from all these other people who are involved with it to get things to change. And so I can give you some examples. So in a lot of cases, when there have been investigations in the police departments and there are consent decrees, a judge or a monitor is put into place to oversee things. And they oftentimes will want to be even-handed, and rightly so. But in doing that, what even-handed often translates to is let's give them the benefit of the doubt and let's take another 6 months, another year to make this change and that change. And that's what leads to slow reform. So that's a judge. A mayor, again, can try to put more pressure on police. But you know what mayors like? They like votes. They like to be elected. And you know what police unions have? Lots of voters. And so a lot of times they're a little bit reluctant to put too much pressure on police unions and police departments to reform. So therefore, it's incumbent on other people in the city, voters, to say to the mayor, look, this is a priority to us. And I think it's evident now that it is to many people in the country, given the massive turnout to the protests.
In regards to data collection, where do you think there's a need for more collection? In other words, are there any blind spots in maybe the data that even the cities in the United States are doing the best? Like, where are they missing research?
Yeah. So this is something I care a lot about. So getting the basic data. So I mentioned the four cities that I thought were the ones that were doing the best in providing current data on stops and frisks. This was Denver, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Seattle. They're providing real-time data the public can view, not just on crime incidents and arrests, but also who's being stopped under suspicion. They might be involved in a crime. What race are they? Are they being frisked? Are they being arrested? Are they actually finding weapons on them, which is the legal justification for these carry stops? That's the kind of information that every department should be providing an up-to-date basis so that the public, who pays for them, or their bosses, can know what they're doing. I mean, this is something I could ramble on for a long time about, that more broadly, like, you know, government, and, you know, as we've shifted to the digital internet world, more and more data is getting online and is available, but there's still way too widespread attitude, especially among people working in government and police departments and courts sometimes, that this is my data and you can't have it, or only if you jump through these hoops can you have it. It's not your data, it's our data. We, the taxpayers, pay for it, we pay for these public services, we pay for the salaries of the the IT people, of the people who decide whether to disseminate the data. It's all paid for by the public, and therefore it should be distributed far and wide as much as possible, of course, with restrictions to protect people's privacy, but that should not be used as an impediment to stop it. So when you ask kind of what data should be around, every big city should have data on reports of crime, arrests of crime, and many do a very good job on those two things. But beyond that, they should have data on who the police are stopping, including information on race, age, gender, when consequences of the stops, so frisks, arrests. In addition to that, more domestic violence data would be great, because I've been looking around the country at that recently, very hard to come by. Shootings data is very inconsistent. This is whether it's police shootings or otherwise. That's really important data to have. On police, complaints against police, and what follow-up there has been. There's been a couple of good studies looking at police complaints in Chicago, one by Max Schanzenbach and Kyle Rosema, Max at Northwestern, another by Bokar Ba, and Governor Rivera. Bokar is a postdoc at the Quattrone Center. Both used data, but they only were able to do that because they and the Invisible Institute Chicago pushed for a long, long, long time to get all this data released. It wasn't other, not just the Invisible Institute, but other institutions as well. So that's an example I happen to know a fair amount about, because they succeeded, they got the data, and they wrote about it, but it shouldn't take that. This should just be out there as a matter of course. And so that's why, you know, to me, the data availability, like, how do you make decisions? How can you make rational policy without having the information? Again, no business can make decisions about how to optimize the way they operate if they don't have information about what is going on. So that's, to me, critical, because this is not just a business. It's a public institution. It's one that answers to the public, to our elected officials, and ultimately to the voters. And so we have a right to know, and we need to know, and we can't make a reasonable policy without having this information. So those are some examples of some of the data that I would expect every big city. And if I were the mayor of a big city and it wasn't up there, but it's one of those 21 of 25 big cities that don't have that data, I would ask, what is our problem, and can we get this up in the next month?
Great. And if you could choose one of your suggestions to become a widely accepted practice tomorrow, which would it be and why?
So this is a tough one, because I think they're all important. I actually think they're a bit intertwined, as talked a little bit about, you know, so for example, like if we just said, you know, tomorrow I snap my fingers and the police unions are amenable to reform, they're willing to not protect bad apples, that would be huge and an immense change, and I think extremely important. Now, would that work? by itself if there weren't data available to help actually figure out who the bad apples are. No, not so much. I mean, to some extent, there would be still egregious incidents, but we wouldn't be able to, like, for example, see who's collected a bunch of complaints without a really bad incident that gets national attention. So we can maybe change this, you know, or have the person with their training change their position or get ultimately kicked off if they're not right for the job. You know, so union reform would be amazing. You'd still have to have data. I think, you know, one thing I haven't talked about too much, you know, was incentivizing individual officers. And this is something that, again, so if unions were formed and they were willing to do that, so that's a necessary first step. But then I think you really have to provide the incentives, give bonuses for officers that are doing the right thing, meaning they are stopping bad guys, but without excessive hundreds over thousands of stops of good guys, or without doing policing in a way that has racial disparities, or without excess shootings. There are ways to figure out how to incentivize people and incentivize individual officers. So I think if you reform the unions, but you don't incentivize people in the right way, again, you get part of the way, but you don't get everything. So that's sort of why I think these things work together. The union one is probably, you know, what catches, I think, a lot of attention because I think it's widespread knowledge that that's problematic. But I really think that's not, you know, they get a lot of the heat, I think deservedly so. But I really think there are these other structural issues that need to change as well. Local involvement, ongoing local focus and involvement and acknowledgement that this isn't, policing isn't just for the police, it's for everyone, is something the mayor should be actively involved in, the district attorney, other attorneys and local judges. Like, it's just, if when we take our eye off it and cede it just to the police department, it may not go in the way that the public wants.
Are you optimistic that this is a turning point in police reform?
I am. I think, so we've seen, this is certainly not the first outcry we've seen. You know, Ferguson comes to mind, Freddie Gray in Baltimore. I mean, we've seen, there are many other names we can list. We've seen a number of other egregious incidents in the last several years, largely due to the availability of, you know, of video these days. That's what's prompted it. We've never seen reactions like this. We've never seen nationwide protests to this level, and we've also never seen actual legislative response that has already begun, both mm-hmm. nationally and in some state legislatures and local municipalities. So that's why I actually am optimistic that this has a chance to change things in a way that those other incidents didn't. I'm not optimistic enough to believe that everything is going to be solved overnight. Attention to this will fade, but I think it's putting the wheels in motion of some things. There's some reform proposals and an awareness among both police and among the country at large that this is and has been an ongoing issue, and think and hope that people are willing to actually put some effort in to really push some of the reforms through, hopefully in a timely manner.
So do you have any other research coming up in the near future? Anything interesting that you're working on that you'd like to talk about briefly before I let you go?
Yeah, absolutely. So just, this obviously has been the most recent event to capture our attention. Before this, if you remember way back, a couple weeks ago before all this erupted, the coronavirus pandemic was a thing that was on everyone's mind, and it's still still very much. So I actually started some research trying to look at a little bit about the intersection between these two, the impact of the pandemic and public responses to it on crime. So how the pandemic affected people's behavior and also lockdowns affected a lot of things, including policing and also including opportunities for crime, targets of crime, et cetera. So I've been working on gathering data from the biggest cities in the country to try to make sense of what has been going on in crime in response to the pandemic. And if all goes well, we should have some preliminary results in the next couple of weeks to try to help, you know, both understand what just happened, but also going forward as, you know, lockdowns have been eased, but to the extent they might need to be put back in place, there's resurgence. This is just one dimension of the pandemic, but it's an important one for public policy. So hoping to have some preliminary results there in a couple of weeks.
Well, thank you for joining us.